Welcome. This is Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Philip Coppens, who is the author of The Ancient Alien Question, A New Inquiry into the Existence, Evidence, and Influence of Ancient Visitors. The foreword from this book is by Eric von Dunkian, who is the author of Chariots of the Gods. Welcome, Philip. I understand you're calling in from Scotland today.
That is correct.
Great. Well, this is a very well thought out book with views both from the true believers and the skeptics, which I appreciate. Can you tell the listening audience a little bit about how you got interested in this field? And I know you are an investigative journalist and someone who is a student of these questions of were we visited in the past by non-humans or extraterrestrials.
Well, I mean, how I became involved is a very long story, which I'll try to condense in a few minutes.
Okay.
Basically, it goes back to the early 1990s, and I was an investigative journalist doing very mundane things like what is there, you know, behind the facade of politics. I come from a political family, as a result, you kind of like know that politics is not what's being reported in the press, which today is absolutely common knowledge. But in the early 1990s, I think this was still pretty much coming something of a novelty. And I was mainly interested in American politics. And in the early 1990s, Oliver Stone was preparing his movie JFK. There were people who I knew who were involved in the production of that. And also, because of the Berlin Wall, which had just fallen, what happened was that an awful lot of information from behind that former Berlin Wall was coming to the West. And specifically, of course, what was of interest was the fact that the alleged assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, basically had spent some time in the Soviet Union in the years leading up to the 1963 assassination. And all of a sudden, almost 30 years later, that information began to come out. And because on his return back to the US, he had passed through the Netherlands, which was very close to where I live then. I'm a native from Belgium. I kind of like became quite involved with this. And also, there were some other people who had connections to Belgium in the 1970s. George de Morenschild, who was a dear friend of Lee Harvey Oswald, had actually lived in Belgium for a while. And all of these things basically meant that I was doing that kind of very mundane, nevertheless, kind of like, you know, interested behind the scenes kind of point of journalism. And at one point, there was somebody called Bill Cooper who came out with this big theory that the reason why Kennedy was assassinated had to do with UFOs. And I, you know, kind of knew what UFOs were. They were things which flew in the sky, but I hadn't really been interested in anything beyond that. So I began to look into that. The allegations by Cooper proved to be completely without foundation, and he later actually apologized, saying he had gotten this information and he was terribly sorry for getting it so wrong. But, you know, it kind of, to me, started a series of interest. One was the fact how people within the CIA had been toying with this notion of UFOs. They had been abusing it, but at the same time, they were intrigued. And a dear friend of mine, Mark Pilkington, actually wrote, I think, a year or two ago, a book called Mirage Men. And in that book, he really goes into how this is real, a hall of mirrors. You have no idea whether the government is deceiving you or whether they're genuinely interested. And I think, actually, the answer is both. But, you know, that kind of like put the alien thing in there. And then in roughly 1993 as well, what happened was that I was working for a publisher, or I began to work for a publisher, and specifically what they wanted to do was for me to promote two of their books into the English language, because they felt that the material covered in these books had to be released to an audience which was larger than just Flanders. And one of the books was about the megalithic civilization by Marcel Mestak, who was a historian who had basically studied the migration patterns of the Vikings, and he had come away with the notion, the theory, that the Vikings were actually looking for Atlantis. And he actually believed that the megalithic civilization, which you know everybody knows about, which is thing as Karnak, Stonehenge, Avebury, these gigantic monuments, which are in various places in France and the UK. And so that was one aspect. The other aspect had to do with the mystery of Reinald Chateau, in which a Flemish person had basically uncovered something, a site which was actually the first archaeological discovery made in the mystery of Reinald Chateau. So I began to do that. I began to look into all of these things. And basically, fast forward to 1995, I really felt that what was happening was that there were various subjects which the likes of Eric von Däniken and numerous other people were delving into on a number of occasions. They were writing books about them, but that there was some of these books, and Eric's books are extremely accessible, but you know he is the exception, I think. Most of the books in the alternative field are almost requiring you to either believe already into something or are so detailed that you kind of go, okay, but what is the big message here? So in 1995, I set up with somebody who's since become a dear friend of mine, Herman Hager, a magazine, newsstand magazine in the Netherlands called Frontier Magazine. At that time, it was called Frontier 2000. The magazine is still running. It's still newsstand. But basically, what we tried to do was bring to a larger audience information in a new way of things happening in the general alternative field in a way which we felt was going to be readable and accessible to everybody, and also basically saying, look, this is what's happening in the alternative field, and we're bringing it to you in a format which we believe is accessible and digestible to everybody. And so that's pretty much what I have been doing since 1995. Then, of course, in 2009, the History Channel became interested in the subject of ancient aliens following the success of the last Indiana Jones movie. They wanted to do a special. They did a two-hour special, and they were stunned beyond their wildest expectations that Ancient Aliens, the two-hour special, became the most highly watched and the most highly rated show for 2009 on the History Channel. And ever since, there have been four seasons of Ancient Aliens so far. The production of season five has just started. It is becoming the longest running series on the History Channels as such. And at the end of season two, it was believed that about 100 million people across the world saw an episode of Ancient Aliens. And actually season three and four, definitely in the States, have been more popular than season one and two. So it is hoped that that figure, once everybody in the world has gotten around to seeing season three and four, that that number is actually going up. But I think that it actually ties into a larger thing, which is that we are and have always been interested in these kind of alternative subjects, whether it's alternative health, whether it's alternative politics, whether it's alternative history. And the reason why we have always been interested into these things is because you can look and see how, you know, some of the book deals of Eric von Däniken and of the Da Vinci Code, various other books have always jumped. And unfortunately, it's only in recent years that television has really come to the fact that there is a genuine interest from the general public out there into the alternative things, and that the general audience is pretty much frustrated by being given this format of party A says something, party B says something completely differently, and nothing is learned. It's just it's like literally, you know, two bulls fighting or two cocks fighting or a sling match between two men in an almost literal ring of boxing. And that is, I think, something which definitely Ancient Aliens is moving away from. And I'm actually hoping that some of the other television channels, specifically Nat Geo, who seems to be still the worst defenders of the old format of presenting alternative information, are kind of like going to catch up and are going to present good information to the general audience, so that television becomes more than just tit for tat, but actually, you know, a medium which is interested to watch.
Yeah, I actually am in a segment on Discovery UK. It's yet to play in the US, but it will be playing on the Animal Planet. It's a show called Monsters Inside Me. You may have heard of it. It's about mold and breast implants. And, of course, this is something that the popular press in the U.S. will not touch. The only real coverage was in Glamour magazine about 10 years ago. But the U.K. and Canada and France have all done shows on it, similar to 2020 here. But, I think that the U.S. press, because of its advertising budgets, often connected to big industry, which often own the products we're trying to tell people about that might have particular dangers, we get shut out terribly. I do want to say I do recognize you from Ancient Aliens, and I wanted to say that just a few days ago I watched a fascinating segment on the possibility that epidemics, we run a medical clinic here as well as a surgical clinic. We have holistic integrative physicians that see very weird diseases. That's what we specialize in. You probably can tell our audience a little bit about the theory that some plagues, maybe the Spanish flu and others, actually came from meteorites. And that segment was fascinating to me as a physician.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's based on the work of Chandra Wickramasinghe, and he is, despite the Indian sounding name, he's a man who's connected to the Welsh University in Cardiff, and he's been looking into this for several years, and he's coming up with great evidence. And unfortunately, even though he's past, I think, the retirement age, he continued to work for the university because of his invaluable contributions to what he was pursuing. But actually, the UK government rather has closed down his position, basically by draining the accounts of the University of Cardiff, whereby it was no longer possible to do that because. In that kind of field, if it isn't about climate change, nobody's interested. And so, unfortunately, Chandra's department definitely was closed, and I think is still closed. But yes, I mean, Chandra has done remarkable work. He was featured in Ancient Aliens, and he, all of his books, there are not that many, but they should definitely be read. And he has been looking into the spread of some of these illnesses, and specifically has shown that the spread of these illnesses is so fast that it cannot have done through human agents or birds or anything like that. And even points out that I think it's a Spanish flu, but I might be mistaken there, that at one point the epidemic hit either Siberia or some completely fenced off area of where basically no ship was coming because it was in the middle of winter, and so that however it had to come from there, sorry, to there had to come from something from outer space. And I think we're getting into to a position whereby we're beginning to actually see that NASA specifically is doing very interesting experiments. And the situation is that for many years, we really were looking for ET through, radio through gigantic beams. And it truly was looking for a needle in a haystack, because we were second guessing, first of all, that ET would be using some kind of radio equipment to broadcast. And then there was speculation as to what in which bandwidth this would be. So there was like assumption upon assumption upon assumption upon assumption upon assumption. And guess what? We'd never heard from ET because it was just, such a small thing to be looking for. It's almost kind of like saying, do you want me to call you? And I kind of say like, yes, but do it on a Wednesday between 12 o'clock and 12:15. That's seconds. That's not, 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, your next shot will be in 25 years from now. That's the kind of reductionist perspective they were putting on this radio contact. But NASA basically changed tack, and they were beginning to look in astrobiology. And when I wrote the chapter on how life might have come from outer space, I basically thought I was just going to do a very quick update on the theory of panspermia, which was proposed by Francis Crick and a few others. And basically, quickly when Crick and others, if I'm not mistaken, Watson, discovered how the structure of DNA looked like, he also came to the conclusion that it was basically impossible that such a complex and perfect copying system, a copy machine basically, had been developed on Earth in a few millions of years, and that this, you know, was so perfect. So he basically felt that DNA or the building blocks of DNA or RNA and all of these things had to come from elsewhere, and that they had to have been formed elsewhere, and that they probably took a ride on a comet, and that as such it was brought to planet Earth. And he even suggested that maybe this was done intentionally, that basically alien civilizations sort of injected DNA on the back of a comet and kind of like sent it out for a ride in the hope of basically creating life on other planets. Well, in 1998-99 thereabouts, a NASA scientist guy called Lou Alamodola did a very interesting experiment, which was that in a laboratory condition, he recreated interstellar space, which is pretty much what most of the universe is made up from. And he came to the conclusion that actually the building blocks of life, specifically RNA, were created or were being created spontaneously in interstellar space, which basically means that life like ours, based on DNA, is likely to exist throughout the universe, and to a large extent, that the universe seems to be naturally inclined to create life like ours. So that was a big discovery. And I actually saw over the last few weeks that some other scientist is trying to claim that he's the one who has discovered this as well. But basically what this scientist has done is he's basically recreated what Alamodola did about a decade ago. But it shows that if DNA and RNA are such universal constants or presences within literally the universe, then the fact that viruses are somehow out there as well, and floating around in the same kind of interstellar space and jump on the back of comets, meteorites and other objects, it's absolutely possible. And it's interesting that it's that not only life seems to come from elsewhere, but that actually that the threats that can kill us come from elsewhere as well.
Well, it's interesting that in Revelations it talks about these great plagues that we don't know if they were already having them or if they're in the future. But certainly, if we were going to be bombarded at a higher rate by meteorites in a certain time period, you might expect plagues to, crop up that were more virulent than because they were from off planet. And I think the Ancient Alien segment on this said that, not only did they would it be very virulent with a high kill rate, but then they would mutate very quickly so that they would not be too devastating, except maybe in a local area, or if there was air travel, of course, that could extend the area. But what's your opinion? Do you think we've seen the plagues like the bird flu, the swine flu, and other plagues like AIDS, or do you think they're in our future?
I think it really depends. I think an awful lot of these things are extremely how should I put this? We are working with so many things ourselves, it's extremely, some of the things which we are doing are extremely dangerous. Going slightly back and kind of like answering your question like that, when I was doing research into the Kennedy assassination, mm-hmm. one of the things was that David Ferry, who was a man who was involved with the Kennedy assassination, he was actually one of the people who was arrested and then was let go because there was no evidence he had been involved, even though it was known that he was involved with all the principal players. He had a somewhat weird disease, and as a result of that, it seems he became interested in experimenting with mice, And in his apartment, at one point, there were 2,000 mice, which was clear, you know, that this wasn't just a simple breeding project, but that they were used for something. Mm-hmm. I actually did about 8-9 months ago. I completed the ebook version of that book, which I had been working on 20 years ago, basically because my wife was driving me insane by constantly quoting what's that book called, the Stephen King book, November 22nd, 1963. And she said, wow, you know, this, wow, that. And I kind of thought, like, okay, this is a guy who's a skeptic. So I decided to make what I had written 20 years ago to actually available as an ebook. Just before I did so, I wanted to look into whether or not I needed to update things. And even though I didn't put it in the book, it is on my website, philipcoppens.com, philipcoppens, if you want to go and look at it there. But what has turned out is that a local guy from New Orleans, where all of this was happening, basically spent 10-15 years of his life delving into this story. And he came away with the quite convincing theory that all of these people in the 1950s and 60s who were involved with these experiments were all doing kind of like, you know, investigations into polio, investigations into various other things. And he specifically is focusing on something, which is that when the world was, you know, succumbing to the fact that children were so being affected by polio, that there was a drive from the government, obviously, to do something about that. And that scientists came up with a polio vaccine, which they kind of knew wasn't perfect. And as a result of that, we're definitely pressured into making it available, even though they knew it had side effects. Part of it seems to be, and kind of like, again, I might be slightly wrong on the details here because it's been a while, but basically that part of the details there had to do with the fact that these things had been tested on monkeys, and that basically there had been errors there, and that some of these errors in testing had resulted in the fact that basically what we're seeing as a cancer epidemic can be traced the current cancer epidemic of the last few decades can be traced back to people who had been given that polio vaccine in the 1950s and the 1960s before it was discovered that, you know, something had dramatically gone wrong, and then basically other steps were happening. But basically, tying this back to the Kennedy assassination, one of these guys, David Ferry, was involved with basically secret experiments because the government knew that something was seriously wrong, but at the same time couldn't admit it was wrong. So all of this work was transferred from pretty much front laboratory kind of stuff to secret laboratory kind of stuff, like David Ferry's apartment, where they were testing out new vaccines. And it's, you know, it's stuff like that which really is of interest. I mean, I was at a conference 5 years ago, I think, in Australia, where a woman was speaking out, a mother who basically had taken her child in for the MMS vaccine, and a few months later, I think, but sometime afterwards, the child developed autism. He became an autistic child, and despite the fact that doctors said, well, you know, basically we can get rid of your child from the point of view that he'll never be normal again, basically treat him as an autistic child, and and she first of all said, you know, well, I think this is due to the MMS thing, and she came upon a wall which basically said, like, it's definitely nothing to do with that. She however, you know, didn't want to give up on both fronts. First of all, she found out that there was definitely a strong link between the MMS vaccine and autism, she basically felt that the dosage of MMS was for some children simply too high. That you know they should have regulated the dosage compared to the state of the child, so to speak, and that in the case of where the dosage was too strong for a specific child, that this seemed to have led to autism. But she also didn't want to let go of the child itself. She really tried everything, not giving up, and being absolutely convinced that she could get her child out of this state, and mm-hmm. She did. She did play therapy. She did everything she could, and her boy is now a healthy, growing up adolescent, if not already a teenager by now. And it are things like that. It are stories of people which basically show you that what is going on today are quite often actions of governments, of physicians, of the industry. Pretty much the world we live in. It's hard to blame people individually, though in specific cases, obviously, individual blame can often be assigned. But it's basically the world we live in, whereby we don't seem to realize that, everything still needs to be done on an individual basis, that no cure exists for 99% of the people. And that is something I think which we quite often tend to forget. And so we continue to develop things which we think are helping us, but would actually are not helping us at all. And to some extent, I think if we are not looking into causes like the fact that some of these viruses might come from elsewhere, we're also actually not helping further science and further medicine either, because we're kind of like living in the wrong notions and we're working from within the wrong framework. And we're not finding cures for cancer. Unfortunately, people in my immediate family were recently diagnosed with forms of cancer, and my sister-in-law actually began to look into this, and despite the fact that some of these cancers have been around for decades, mm-hmm. despite the fact that specifically in the UK here, there are dozens of cancer organizations, charities, who are actually more interested in finding cure for cancers and helping that study rather than helping the people get through the process of living with or surviving cancer or recovering from cancer. Despite all of these things, there was not a single case of a person actually recovering from a melanoma. And that is something I think which is of interest. And I think one of the reasons is that, and this is not just something which I see in medicine, but it's also in history. It is because we operate within the wrong framework. If you don't give somebody the right framework in which to say, okay, this is the problem, find a solution. If the problem is misrepresented, if the origins are misrepresented, then it's very unlikely that somebody's going to come up with an answer.
I agree totally. I mean, especially with cancer. I've done this radio show for 17 years, so obviously I've talked to a lot of people. And specifically with cancer, I believe cancer is a fourth dimensional intrusion into the third dimension, similar to diseases like Morgellons and schizophrenia. And the cures I've seen have come from shamanic means. In other words, shamans closing off this portal. And what's so interesting is there was a psychiatrist who said that he studied 5,000 of his patients who were schizophrenic, and none of them had progressive cancer. They might develop a tumor, but then it would regress. And then there was a researcher in Canada who started dripping Thorazine on cancer stem cells and showing that they reverted to normal. So it's very interesting to think that antipsychotics might actually work by closing down portals between dimensions, and at least in some cases might have a serious anti-cancer effect. And you've got to be able to explain spontaneous remission. You've got to be able to explain why within 3 or 4 minutes someone who's riddled with cancer suddenly has no evidence of disease. And you can't do that within a third dimensional framework. You just can't. And I've spoken to physicists, Amit Goswami, and other super string people. I interviewed Maka Kichu. I've interviewed all of the great minds of the world, and they do say that we must be looking in the wrong direction.
Well, I mean, you know, it's unfortunate, but I think it's true, and it's very unfortunate because, you know, people are dying, and again, what I hate and what I hate about it is also, you know, the fact that somehow this is then blamed. I mean, I'm not giving them a clean bill of health here, pun maybe intended, but the pharmaceutical companies are basically blamed of saying, well, you know, the cure for cancer has been found, and you know, they're just suppressing it. It's a very conspiratorial thing. I mean, you know, on a side note, people constantly are asking me about the Thrive movement, like what you like about it, and it's kind of like, well, I don't, because it's still saying that there is fear, and one of the things which an awful lot of this conspiracy mongering and so-called or pretend revelationist movements are going on about is basically saying, you know, you have to be afraid because there are big people out there. So what we're going to do is tell you that there are big people out there. And so you can know the truth, but you still need to be afraid. And by the way, you can't do anything about it because they're all powerful. And you know, first of all, you know, that is very sad. And really what I don't like at all, and it's something which I actually go on about, I think, in chapter two of the book, which is the Alien Overlords chapter, which is that they're actually saying, like, well, you know, it's not even Obama, it's not even the Illuminati, the word which they love to use, but it's actually aliens who are somehow sitting in another, you know, world, another, you know, spaceship or another wherever they sit, and they're the ones who are directing mankind through. Well, first of all, that's completely against all the evidence of kind of like belief in non-human intelligences. All civilizations who reported encounters with non-human intelligence always said that this was beneficial and cooperative. But also it's even more disempowering because, you know, like, kind of like, you know, if you say that the Illuminati are eight people who are controlling the world, well, you know, at some point we'll identify those eight and maybe we can throw a few of them in jail. But if there are eight aliens who are sitting on a different planet, you know, we have even decommissioned the space shuttle, so we wouldn't be even able to go and get those. So it's all of this disempowering and the fear mongering, and it's this fear mongering which isn't helpful either. You know, people who live in constant fear, who are disempowered by default, are going to be open to more diseases because they're not happy, and they have been told to some extent that they can't be happy. But on a more positive note, yes, you know, if we were to assume for 1 second that we are part of a larger framework, and that there is something out there which is to be explored, and something which, you know, is maybe of another dimension, that might actually help us. And I think that is something which, you know, needs to be done more. And again, science is, you know, there are certain things to be said about, let's just all look in the laboratory and pretend that there is no such thing, you know, as beyond the walls of physical reality, and let's see whether we can come up with something which basically does that. And I think in the case of curing a headache, you know, that's probably true. I think there are certain illnesses which we are affected by, which are purely physical.
Right. You know, there are. And some our cancer is physical. Like, mm-hmm. If I stick my hand in a you know, lead vault with radium in it, I'm likely to develop cancer on my hand. Mm-hmm. You see, there are physical causes of cancer. You know, you can take in a carcinogen in, and you can get cancer from it. You can take a parasite in, and it can cause cancer. Those have all been proven in the laboratory. But there may be multidimensional effects of, you know, a lot of diseases, but specifically cancer, because so many cases of spontaneous remission involve cancer. That's what I was looking at, is how, you know, when you study spontaneous remission, you see how what categories it falls into.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one of the things which I liked is that my wife's family has a cabin near Big Bear in California, and we were once, when we were hiding out there because we were writing books, we were invited by our neighbors there about 3 years ago. And he basically had developed prostate cancer. And when he had recovered from it, he wanted to basically help other men in mm-hmm. kind of like going through the process. And he basically said, you know, that from the first phone call, when somebody phones the hotline and he answers the phone, he could tell whether somebody was going to get through that, or whether he was eventually going to succumb to the prostate cancer. And, you know, mm-hmm. he said the one thing which was a telltale sign was attitude.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that was the winner, or that was the losing, you know, qualifier in that debate. And it's you know, I think indeed the same. Like, you know, cancer is quite common these days. Everybody has people, and I see you know, people who are fighting and beating the odds. A dear friend of ours has stage 4 cancer and just refuses to die. She basically believes that this cancer is not going to kill her, and she should have been that pretty much 2 years ago. And she basically feels that this cancer is incapable of killing her. And you know, it's that kind of attitude of beating and not giving up that really I find is of interest. And that is something which you cannot reduce into, you know, a tablet. That is something of the mind. And whether you believe that the mind is something which is larger than just this reality, or whether the mind is, you know, just something within this reality, it clearly shows that there is a component of the mind to this. But again, you know, all the cancer research which I know, all the other kind of things which the approach of science as a whole completely excludes this mind aspect. And that is, you know, that is, I think, probably one of the reasons why there are so little advances in these things. And that is not just something which, you know, I find abominable in the space of medicine science. It's something which is a deep problem within science as a whole. I mean, my focus is mainly on history and how we are, you know, given a history which is absolutely not the real history of our species, and something which, you know, not just tens of thousands of years ago, or a few thousands of years, or a few hundreds of years, but on a daily basis, we are led down a path by various people thinking or believing that what is happening in the world is in a certain way, and that is something which you know is so ill addressed by science. And we constantly reduce reality to something whereby it's in the case of history, and in the case of archaeology, definitely it becomes a game. And unfortunately, you know, it's you know, I quite often see the same symptoms in other things. When it comes to climate science, there seems to be this debate somehow that, you know, you have on the one hand the people who absolutely believe in climate science, who are the good guys, and then the other people who, you know, pretend as if climate science is not proper science, who then are somehow, you know, immediately put into the camp of the big oil companies, who somehow, you know, want the world not to know about the fact that there is climate change. Well, guess what? Who's actually benefiting from this notion that our governments are, you know, convinced and are promoting the fact that there is climate change? It's the big oil companies who get, as a whole, hundreds of millions of dollars from our money because we somehow have convinced ourselves that there is climate change, and therefore we're giving these big oil companies enormous amounts of money into coming up with new technology whereby somehow, you know, they can continue to provide us with fuels, but in a way that should not be contributing to climate change. It's again, it's this complete reductionist perspective of some something which is extremely complex. And what people don't seem to realize is that in science there are no real, you know, straightforward answers. It is based upon assumption, and to a large extent, it's a game. I mean, the game I like to tell the most is the fact that in 1982, there was radiocarbon dating of the pyramids in on the Giza Plateau, and they showed that these two main pyramids there, were roughly 700 years older, and that the Great Pyramid was actually more recent than the pyramid next door. And that is precisely the other way around of what Egyptologists believe. Well, you know, these results were done in 1982. They have not been published in a peer-reviewed journal. And as a result of that, for the last 30 years, every single Egyptologist has gotten away with pretending that these results don't exist. And, you know, that is a game. It's a game which is being played whereby facts are simply thrown out of the door because the people who are playing the game somehow feel it is an inconvenient truth which they, you know, don't want to look into the eye. And again, it happens in so many sciences that basically, you know, it's laughable. But it is sad because at the end of the day, you know, it's us ordinary citizens who feel used and abused because we are placed in a situation whereby we are lied about as to the world we live in. We're lied about as to you know, where we come from and who we are. We are, you know, basically treated with kind of like, okay, you know, you're kind of like looked after, but really it is not. And we go through a pretend democracy. And at the end of the day, you know, it's a very sad state of affairs. And unfortunately or fortunately, as with all, you know, these things, it is completely artificial. It's not based in reality. And I'm actually glad to see that without any involvement from ordinary citizens, this completely artificial framework, which was fortunately or unfortunately created all too quickly out of thin air, is slowly decomposing and you know, falling apart. And I can only hope that it is sooner rather than later, and that something new will rise from its ashes, which is more interested and more caring about you know, billions of people, hundreds of thousands of people dying in Africa on a you know, not necessarily daily but yearly basis, who nobody, you know, gives anything about. A child in Africa dies every 3 to 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we have and a long way to go in taking care of the what we have here on the planet. A long way to go.
And you know, the thing about Africa is that we only really care about the fact that we can export to these countries arms which we no longer use, which we give to these people, so that they can find over a line in the sand, which doesn't mean anything to them, except that we've told them that it is important, and therefore they fight and they kill. And as a result of that, you know, I mean, Africa cannot feed itself, or parts of Africa cannot feed itself, not because it's Africa and somehow these people are, you know, incapable of doing so, but because we've made it a complete war zone. And you cannot grow tomatoes in a field which is laden with bombs.
Right, right. Yeah, that's true. Well, let's go back a little bit on the kinds of evidence that one would need to take a look at the ancient alien question. In your book, you've kind of subdivided it. Do you want to briefly talk about the kinds of evidence that, you know, the different categories, and then we'll just refer people to your book to, you know, to read about the details in each of these categories?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, the one thing I say is that we have been always looking for physical contact with ET, a physical ET who's out there, proverbially who would land on the lawn of the White House and would shake hands with the president. You know, heaven forbid he would land on the cobblestones of the Kremlin and shake hands with a Khrushchev or one of those people. But you know, that hasn't happened, and the evidence for that, there is some evidence for that this actually has happened. But statistically speaking, And, you know, there are lies, damned lies, and statistics. But statistically speaking, there are only ever going to be in recorded history a few instances of that happening. And in the book, I actually point out that there are only like a few instances of this happening. And some of it is quite incidental. It's you know, stories of a crash in a remote part of China whereby a spaceship crafts and ET starts to interbreed with our ancestors, which sounds preposterous until you begin to realize that, you know, again, DNA seems to be universal, literally universal to the universe. And so why wouldn't it be possible? That is one category. And I think ancient aliens as an area has been too much focused on that, which is why, you know, it really took a very long time for it to gain any real ground, I think, within the general population. I think what I try to show is that we also need to look into other kinds of contact with non-human intelligences, specifically through telepathic or other kind of methodologies. And I show how this has been done since the 1970s. Mm-hmm. The likes of Terence McKenna, Jeremy Narby moved into basically the Amazon rainforest in search of hallucinogenic substances, in the case of Jeremy Narby, in case of different ways in which pharmaceutical companies could engineer drugs. He felt that the Amazon was a vast laboratory and that people from the big drug companies should actually go and see the methods in which the shamans of that area were going about their business, and he did. But a component of the work which they were doing, and specifically Terence McKenna was doing, was that they realized that they made contact with non-human intelligences, and that they basically said, yes, we are an intelligence. Yes, we are willing to give you answers if you want to know the answers to the questions you have. And in the case of Terence McKenna, this was basically an equation of time. They basically told him that time wasn't a byproduct of gravity, but that time was a fractal wave, and that is important. And so that is something which I wanted to put into the book as well, basically saying that it's just wider than physical contact. And then, of course, as I said earlier, I was really pleasantly surprised that when I was writing about the theory of panspermia, I just thought I was going to do a quick update about the theory of Francis Crick, but that so much more had happened there, and that it really came to the conclusion that life is universal, that life exists everywhere in the universe. And guess what? Those people who are doing that kind of discovery work are working for our government. They are people from NASA. They are proper scientists. And do you know that they have actually abandoned the scientific method of peer review because they basically say it is completely flawed and run by people who are absolutely unwilling to even consider the possibility that life comes from outer space. And so what they have done is basically do science by press release, whereby they say we have written this thing. It's been tested. These are the conclusions we've reached. It's been duplicated. Blah blah blah. All of that stuff. And here you have it, general public. Now, guess what? You know, the skeptics here are then accusing of NASA as being involved in some kind of illuminous or illustrious agenda to somehow convince the world of the existence of ET. Really, some people of our species are our own species' worst enemies. And that is kind of basically the conclusion I say within the book as well. The traditional thing is like, you know, ask me to jump and the question is how high. No matter what kind of evidence of contact with non-human intelligences anybody has made in the last 40 years, the burden of proof, the burden of evidence has always been raised for the very simple reason that there are people within the corridors of science who simply do not want to look at it, who simply do not want to be confronted with this. So it really is, oh, well, you have jumped, 2 yards high now. Could you jump 3 yards? And when you do, how about 4 yards? It'll constantly be raised. And that is basically the conclusion in the book, which is that, that we're stuck. We're stuck as a species because it's a game which is being played on a field which is not a level playing field. And this is, you know, something where the ancient alien question falls victim of. But it is just one victim, and unfortunately, you know, it is not just the only victim. It is one of, you know, several victims. Yes. The fact that, science somehow has been able to pretend that they're not, you know, required to look whether or not we have a soul, whether something survives our body after death, is really kind of, you know, the worst kind of crime we're letting science get away with. But now, with the present financial crisis and the various political crises, it seems the world is not really interested in kind of like, you know, reining this cancerous thing called science in. And so, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think the main problem, as I see it, my brother is a scientist in atmospheric chemistry, who is very much involved in what the government and NASA is doing, and highly published, and, you know, is hangs out with Nobel laureates. And my brother is not capable of understanding multidimensional reality. He just doesn't, it's not in his framework to understand. And maybe rightly so, because in his world, that wouldn't help him, and it would only hurt him. But, you know, I interview physicists, chemists, biologists, scientists from all over the world who do understand multidimensional reality and how it impacts in terms of our new discoveries of dark matter and dark energy. I've interviewed Russell Targ on many occasions. And, you know, I just wanted to mention to you that my spiritual mother spent, I think, about 4 months in a house with Geller. And Geller said to her that his powers came entirely from extraterrestrial source. And if the extraterrestrials decided not to participate, he couldn't do anything. So, I mean, you know, as far as I see, without incorporating this extraterrestrial, and in Geller's case, it was a higher dimensional extraterrestrial. It was not somebody that, or people that appeared in our dimension. We're just not getting it. We're not able to see the entire playing field. And without the ability to see the entire playing field, there's no way we can understand things like the ancient alien question.
No, and I mean, two quick anecdotes. One, actually, the place where I'm in Scotland is actually from my kitchen window. I can see the island which Uri bought a few years ago, the Isle of Lamb, just off the coast of North Berwick. And I know Uri, so he's quite a good friend. The second thing is that my father is an atheist. My mother actually, my mother was Catholic, and my father is my mother still is Catholic, and my father is an atheist. And at one point we had a kind of like a dinner discussion, whereby my dad basically said, like, well, I'm an atheist, so you know, when I die, there won't be anything for me. To which I pointed out that that is what he believes, but that is not necessarily, you know, what happens. It's like you can believe that if you smash a car, you know, into a wall, that you're not going to die. But that is merely belief. It doesn't necessarily mean that when you do smash your car into a wall, you're not going to die. In fact, the odds are that you probably will. So, you know, this atheists and you know, most scientists seem to live within this framework that simply because they don't believe something, it doesn't exist. which I find is very interesting, kind of like, you know,
it is.
Okay, well, I don't believe in, you know, I mean, kind of like, I can't comprehend genocide. You know, I have seen people commit genocide. I have gone to things like Srebrenica and things like that. I can't get my head around it, but I know it exists. I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, somehow for some people, not seeing is believing, or not seeing is not believing, whatever the correct way of that term should be.
There's people out there who claim the Holocaust never happened, you know. I mean, they obviously are saying what they believe, because they, just like you say. But you're right. I mean, we have certain perceptual tools, and some of our perceptual tools, like in the case of Uri Geller, in the case of, you know, the people that Russell Targ worked with, their perceptual tools are much expanded than the average person. And, you know, so they perceive an expanded world, including multiple dimensions. And that can be very handy when you're trying to find, you know, where, you know, where things are lost, or where, you know, where the kidnappers took, you know, Patricia, you know, after that, you know, it can be very useful in law enforcement. But I just think we have to say that we have very different perceptual realities, because we basically have different perceptual abilities. And I can't say that this person, his or her perceptual reality isn't true. And I think we have to respect each other, just like, you know, I may not, you know, believe in Hinduism, but I certainly would defend the right of a person to believe, you know, to be a Hindu, or to be a Muslim, or to be a Christian, or to be a, you know, whatever religion, to be an atheist. You know, I mean, I think we all have that right to believe what we want.
Yes, but at the same time, I think there's also, you know, something which basically says that you can't impose your belief system on other people. And
right.
That, I think, is unfortunately where science goes wrong, because they somehow feel that they know better, that somehow we are
right.
fools.
Yeah.
You know, I
well,
mean,
science
it's
is a god to them.
I mean you know,
there are
two beautiful
system. You know?
Sorry, there are two beautiful aspects there. One of them is in Contact. You know, Carl Sagan's book. I wasn't a fan of Carl for most of his life, but like, you know, when I looked at what he had done with Contact, specifically the movie, mm-hmm. which, you know, was completed posthumously. I mean, there are several beautiful lines, and the entire story, I think, is really a voyage of exploration, which is also why throughout the book I kind of like refer to it quite a bit. But there is this line of when Matthew McConaughey says to Jodie Foster, you know, I couldn't put somebody on that craft which is going to make contact with an alien intelligence, who basically felt that 99% from the world's population suffers from some kind of mental disease, who thinks that believing in God is somehow, you know, an illness. And unfortunately that is you know, an awful lot of what science is about. They think that they are, you know, better. There's a debate here raging in the UK between, like, in America, you know, the two political parties. Basically, they have finally realized that the Conservatives somehow seem to treat most of the UK people as less than them, because they went to the posh schools, they had the best education. So they basically feel that the only purpose of an ordinary UK citizen is to vote for them, and they will feed them and give them jobs. But they are really, you know, a lower class kind of group, which shouldn't be taken completely seriously. And I don't know why all of a sudden this has come as a revelation that there are people like that out there. But, you know, it is very much the case of science as well. They really believe that they have this crusade whereby the mission is to convince the world, you know, that there is no such thing as another dimension or other dimensional intelligences, that there is no such thing as something of the soul which exists beyond this scope. And mm-hmm. You know, Rupert Sheldrake has completed a new book which I haven't read yet. The UK title is The Science Delusion. I think the US title is called Science Set Free. And unfortunately, I think the American title is not as good as the UK title, because mm-hmm. It basically, he talks about the fact that science, you know, really treats the world as idiots. That mm-hmm. that scientists are absolutely convinced of the fact that there is no soul, that there is nothing within this framework of theirs which should be expanded to accommodate for certain factors. And he basically, you know, gives various examples of how, as a result, we're not making advances in science, but how science, you know, continues to get our tax money, mm-hmm. gigantic donations from various, you know, organizations. And we actually, you know, this wouldn't be too bad if we only entrusted them with minor things. But we actually have entrusted them with the most important things, our health, you know, who we are, our history, so many aspects we have entrusted right. science with. And I have to say...
And they're stuck, you know, they're well, just stuck.
I mean, you know, apart from the fact that they're stuck, and I think you can actually drop the T there, and I think it, they suck as well. but apart from those two things, there is no control. You know, we right. do not control them. We cannot tell them.
I think corporations control them, unfortunately.
Well, I think even they...
Anyway. Governments and corporations.
I think they control them to the sense that they can actually, you know, withdraw their funding.
Right. Exactly.
But apart from that, they very much are, you know, a standalone runaway thing. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's some of these things beggar belief. I'm going to take an example from archaeology, whereby, mm-hmm. You know, a government-paid archaeologist can get away with saying, well, I went on that dig in the summer, but I'm going to write my report, but the report will only be finished in like 20 years from now. I mean, you know, you right. try saying that to your boss at work when he says, like, did you go to that meeting? Yes, yeah. sir, I did. When can I see the report? 20 years from now, sir. I don't think right. your boss is going to like that. Yet somehow we let scientists get away with it. As a result of which, you know, 80% of what scientists uncovered in Italy has never even been written up. The museums mm-hmm. in Italy are filled, well, the museums of the world, but mainly in Italy, are filled with things from the Roman Empire where nobody knows where it comes from, how mm-hmm. it was found, in what context it was found, whether it's important or not. None of these things are known for 80% of what has been found in Italy. And, you know, when it comes to things like medicine and health industry, you know, we have somehow come to the conclusion that it is really hard to find a cure for cancer. And the reason why we think it is so hard is because we've been trying to look for it for decades now when we haven't found it. So it must be hard, right? Well, maybe it's just because
except that those doctors who are curing cancer, and a lot of them are curing cancer with means that involve electromagnetic fields and other things more in biophysics and in biochemistry, are asked to cease and desist by certain portions of our government. And I'm not saying that as part of a conspiracy theorist. I'm saying this because I know the individuals involved.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, I mean, it's absolutely true that certain fields of investigation, be it intracellular diseases like mycoplasma, or be it electromagnetic fields in terms of cancer, are forbidden to be investigated. I mean, you just don't. And I know this because I interviewed the author of the Cell Wall Deficient Forms textbook, and she told me that she found the same intracellular spirochete in 30 cases of MS and had a court order by the U.S. government not to share her findings with any physicians. So, you know, I'm not – this isn't conspiracy theory. This is me talking to the individuals involved.
Mm-hmm.
Certain areas of investigation are totally shut off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, totally. If you pursue them, you may actually, you know, have a heart attack when you had no history of heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's what happens. I mean, that is actually the facts of what happens. So, you know, and be it national security. I was in the military for 13 years. I had a high security clearance. I understand the need for national security, but this goes well beyond that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sorry.
I think it's financial. I think, you know, that the $8 billion that the U.S. spends a year in cancer care is a status quo now, and they don't want to change it.
Well, and I think it's also, unfortunately, a lot about control. You know, we are in a situation whereby we fear our governments, and that is precisely where, you know, the people of the world need to be, according to governments. Because
that's set up by the government, by the way.
Well, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, even if you create 15,000 levels of government, which everybody seems to be so interested in doing these days, at the end of the day, we outnumber them. And there were, on a number of occasions in Belgium in the early 1990s, Brussels being obviously the capital of Belgium, but also the headquarters of the EU. And I've always been interested in the Belgian Revolution because basically in 1830, about 500 people went to a play, walked out, said, this Dutch government is crap. We're going to do something about this. And 12 hours later, Belgium was independent. And it basically meant that, 250 people or so created independence. They basically said, enough is enough. We're fed up with this. We're not continuing to do this. And what happened was, that in the early 1990s, because the farmers from across Europe came to Brussels, Brussels basically became a barbed wire city for the days when the farmers were going to come, because when they came with their tractors, nothing was safe. And I remember once walking in the morning through the streets of Brussels, and the police were setting up with water cannons and, like barbed wire and all of these things. And I kind of thought, like, it really depends on which side of that fence those police officers are going to stand, because if they stand on the other one and they point everything on the other side, the Belgian government would collapse, but also the EU government would collapse. And then in the aftermath, or when the Iraq War was happening, at one point there was in the streets of London 2 million people who took to the streets in protest against the government, basically, I wouldn't even say siding along with George Bush, but actually setting out together with George Bush the agenda of attacking Afghanistan and invading Iraq. Those 2 million people didn't realize that at that moment in time, if they so wanted to, could have brought down the world as we knew it. They far outnumbered anything which could ever have done something. In situations like that, the police is more than likely to do nothing whatsoever, if something were to go out of hand. And it's purely because those 2 million people didn't believe that it could change the world, that the world didn't change. It took three centuries after the Roman Empire basically could have been taken over and would have fallen for somebody to realize that the Roman Empire was too weak to defend itself. And so it took 3 centuries, 300 years longer for the Roman Empire to really fall. The people of this world don't know how powerful they are because they live within a framework whereby they are basically told, again, through conspiracy theories to the government, through whatever means possible, that, it's hopeless, that they can't do anything about this. In the case of the euro crisis, and in the case of the subprime mortgage things and all of these things, they are, even aided and abetted by the politicians, who basically say that they couldn't do anything about this as well. Well, money isn't real. Money has stopped being real. I think, probably
For
like a
some
thousand
time.
years, yeah, 1,000 years ago or so. Right now, it's all numbers. The way these things are done is completely artificial. It's based on ridiculous things. And when you realize that at one point in the subprime fiasco, people were getting millions of dollars in bonuses because they had developed a system whereby they were making money from betting about the fact that their own company was going to lose money because of bad investments. That is simply incredible. I mean, my mind, just like with genocide, my mind can't go there. I mean, first of all, I mean, not so much the fact that these people can do that, but how we live in a world where a system is created, whereby somehow money can be made by claiming and betting about the fact that your company is going to lose money. I mean, it's a betting industry. It belongs in Vegas, and even in Vegas, it's probably frowned upon. but somehow it drives the world financial system, or drove the world financial system. And guess what? It drove the world financial system in a complete pit, deeper and probably more horrible than anything, you know, Satan could create. And then nobody did anything about it. Nobody, you know, did anything when people across the world, you know, are suffering. People have lost their houses. People have lost their jobs. You know, we pretend that this euro crisis is not a, you know, I mean, in Greece right now, if you break your leg and you go into a hospital, the doctors will tell you they can set your leg. But in a number of hospitals, they will tell you that they cannot put you in a cast for the very simple reason that the hospital doesn't have the money, so they couldn't buy the casting material. However, if you somehow are financially able and, you know, can get to a supply store or whatever, if you can provide the money and specifically the material, then they will be happy to put your arm, your leg, or whatever you've broken into a cast. And it is simply because, you know, somehow we are creating a game whereby we're saying austerity, people, you know, Greece needs to be austere. And it's just one example of you know, hundreds of thousands of examples, which has a real effect on people in Greece. You know, 50% of youth in Spain are unemployed. You know, 50% of youth in Egypt was unemployed just under 2 years ago.
And that's what leads to the unrest, as you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of statistic, especially with the youth, because they, you know, they're not content just to sit at home and watch TV and then lose their home and, you know, lose their TV. You know, they do take to the streets. And
I mean, if you are 22 years old and you are absolutely convinced that the system which you are a part of is not going to provide you with money, to not do anything whatsoever, you know, because that's an option. Kind of like, you know, I mean, you know, part of Western style economy is that there will always be some kind of unemployment. That's great. That's built into the system. And as long as we don't start saying, "Hey, people who are unemployed, you're lazy bums who sit on their asses," you know, as long as we stop going that far. It's part of the system. It's taken for granted, and the system has basically said, okay, you know, we will provide money for those people because this is the framework which we've decided to operate our social life in. Fine.
And, you know, the problem is, too, Spain and Egypt both have, and Greece, a great deal of their income, national income, is from tourism. And as things become shaky, as the place becomes less safe and less friendly, then that goes too. And so actually they're digging their own, you know, their own grave as far as you know, national money coming in from the outside goes. And I was looking at the riots in Egypt and going, oh my God, you know, what percentage of Egypt's income is tourism? I mean, it has to be being damaged now.
Oh, I mean, you know, it's one of the things which about Egypt, first of all, you know, don't believe anything you read in the newspapers. But in 1997 or 1998, a bus was attacked just outside of the temple of Queen Hatshepsut, just outside of Luxor. And it is known that the people who did that came from outside of Egypt, because they were basically extremist people who felt that the Egyptian people weren't Muslim enough. You know, they weren't what was proper. It was too democratic, it was too liberal, it was every, you know, like Egypt was good. So they decided to basically bring Egypt to its heels. And what happened was they came from abroad, they hijacked this bus, and before the police came, the local, you know, guy who sold whatever statues he had to make his living, ran to their house, take guns or whatever they had, and they were going to lynch these terrorists themselves, because they realized that they were going to, you know, they realized, first of all, what was happening, but specifically they realized that, you know, they were going to prefer to shoot a terrorist rather than let anything happen to a tourist. Now, unfortunately, you know, they arrived before the police arrived, but they already arrived too late. But for, you know, a period of a year to a year and a half, people realized that they would be unable to feed their family. They would have, you know, no income to feed their family. And so tourism, you know, is affected. And again, for completely Western, you know, Western nations like Spain and Greece, it's a problem. In Greece, they have decided to close some of these tourist attractions. Hotels have decided to close, as a result of which nobody goes. In Spain, they have tried to do a different approach. In Spain, they have tried to reduce the prices of hotels in the hope of still getting people there. But that requires, you know, government spending, and very aggressively saying to foreign governments to run ads on CNN, to run ads on everything, and basically saying, "Come!" But guess what? You know, the Spanish government is constantly being dragged in front of one meeting or another, whereby they say, pretty much say, you know, don't even spend a million, let alone a billion, on such things because austerity, austerity, austerity. As a result of which, I mean, we do tours in France, but over the summer, some of our tours actually went into parts of Spain, and you can see the hotels being empty. I mean, it's great to tell to your people, you know, here's a five star hotel for the price of what you paid for a 3-star hotel. Nice upgrade, isn't it, people? But it's sad to see that happening, pretty much because you realize, that it's kind of, how should I put it? It's not everywhere in Spain, but in certain parts of Spain, it's pretty much walking around. When I say post-apocalyptic environment, it's obviously, you know, too big of a word, but it's that kind of attitude. That kind of feeling. It's somehow this idea of like, it's lovely that we have all of these things, but it's not the kind of atmosphere of a real holiday experience. And so, you know, Spain is being affected. Definitely this year. Greece, it's been going on for a bit longer. And again, you know, the Egyptian revolution came about because 22-year-old basically said this government, which, by the way, took billions in corruptions into their own pockets, isn't providing us with a future. You know, we're not going to sit on our bums and do nothing about this. In Spain, there are continuous protests, which seem to have no effect whatsoever. You know, the rest of the world seems to be lagging behind a bit. But, you know, looking into the future, it's easy to see that, you know, Obama is probably going to be reelected, is unable to bring about real change. By default, it'll be somebody new after 4 more years. That person, too, will either be a complete failure or will once again not be able to bring about change. And it truly depends on whether the Republicans in 4 years from now have had their act together and can actually decide who they want to elect themselves before trying to convince the world or the rest of America, you know, that the person they've nominated is actually somebody they like. And at that moment in time, you know, the people of America will be as well in more serious problems than they are right now, which, you know, compared to states like Greece is you know, I spent time in Europe, I spent time in the States and in various other countries, and life right now in America is, compared to some parts of the world, still quite sheltered and definitely quite good. The issues which are being faced there are, you know, to a large extent manageable. There are no serious. Mm. There's no serious.
As long
things.
As we stay out any more wars.
Yes, and I mean to some extent also, like, you know, like subprime. You know, it means that people can't move out. That people have moved in. You know, that the children sometimes had to move back in with the parents or vice versa. Well, you know, most homes in America were built to quite a large and substantial standard. There's also space around them. You know, they have a garden, and all of these things. They have air conditioning. All of these things are things which 100 miles, not even 100 miles, 50 miles from here towards Glasgow, you basically have the same situation, but it is in a high-rise building with, you know, like 7, 8 people living in a council estate. Their only recourse is, you know, something which is about, you know, 32 to 45 inches across, and it's called a television, which is the only thing which basically is for them there, and there is no escape from anything else. And, you know, that is a situation, and even they have it, you know, relatively easy compared to situations elsewhere in the world. But again, if nothing is done, once the, I wouldn't say evil, but the thoughtless actions which are controlling this game, and which people, you know, politicians don't realize because they do live in ivory towers. They live an extremely privileged life. They, you know, by their lifestyle, they have no way of looking at anything else. You know, they don't have time to do certain things, to meet real people, and let alone connect with them. As a result of that, you know, they live in ivory towers, and those ivory towers are by default high, and lovely and protected. But if they don't do anything relatively quickly, then, you know, those ivory towers are going to become radically encroached upon by the towers of, you know, dissatisfaction, and the towers of the council estates, and you know, the places in the world where it is having a detrimental effect on people. And, you know, so it's almost like we're getting to a situation where it's in their best interest to actually do something good for a change for the people. And, you know, it's an interesting situation that the best form of greed might actually be to give something. You know, I think it's actually gotten to that stage whereby if the present state, the present situation is not going to be changed, then it's either going to be toppled, or, you know, change is going to come from within. And toppling things is a very inefficient way of doing things. It only means that, you know, people with no power whatsoever have to figure it out all for themselves, which means there are delays. Quite often it means that caught in the
It's
past.
chaos sometimes.
Like, you have the Muslim Brotherhood, which isn't a party which, you know, came about 2 days ago. It, you know, I think they came to they into their existence in the 1920s or the 1930s, but they've never ruled. You know, they have absolutely no idea what it is to be in power, and I have seen that. You know, the Labour Party in the 1990s in the UK, the Socialist Party in the 1990s in Belgium. These were people who pretty much for you know, generation had not been in power, and all of a sudden these people who had been shouting, saying, you know, the government is doing it wrong. I mean, I said at the start of this show, I come from a party of politicians, and one member, actually my family covers all sides of the political perspective, so there's always somebody who has a government in power. But in this case, in the 1990s, Socialist Party hadn't been in power for a very long period of time, and an entire generation of them hadn't been in power. And one very specific member of that party, you know, was a constant guy who was telling the previous governments, "This is bad. This is bad. You should do this differently." And he found himself to be Minister of the Interior when his party came into power. And after a few months, he basically, kind of like said, "You have no idea. On a daily basis, I have to cover up so many things. The people of Belgium would create a revolution if they knew what I have to cover." And he basically said,
Oh
so,
my.
you know, he said, like,
Well.
"Half of the things which I have to cover up are completely unimportant. The other half I don't want to cover up, but there's always some reason which somebody will tell me as to why I have to do this.
Why you have to do it to maintain order.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
And
true. Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour now. Would you mind giving your contact information one more time?
Absolutely. The easiest way is to go to my website, which is www.philipcoppens.com, and that is spelled PHILIPCOPPENS. If you type in that name in either Twitter or Facebook, you will come to me as well. Specifically, if you want to do it directly, for example, on Twitter, just type in twitter.com/PhilipCoppens. Or if you want to do it directly on Facebook, just do it around. Do it the other way around. Do facebook.com/CoppensPhilip. But basically, go to my website, and there are two easy, awaitable icons waiting for you to be clicked upon, so you can follow me that way as well.
Would you like to give our listeners any words of wisdom before we wrap up?
Absolutely. First of all, don't think anything about disempowering you. Everybody of us needs to be empowered, and everybody has a right to feel positive and joy. And everybody who thinks that somehow you cannot live a beautiful life, basically ask yourself why they are doing that. However, don't stress out about it to the point that you yourself don't feel happy. There is a road out of most crises, and there are ways of being happy. And in most cases, it does involve some form of courage. But there are ancient sayings, and I think the reason why they're ancient sayings are because they are true, and that is to thy own self be true. We really know each other, and somehow the older we get, in some people it's beaten out of us. We are literally beaten down, and that leads to illness, that leads to disappointment. But just go back in time if you feel that you have lost contact with yourself, and get in touch with your true self, and realize that we are all powerful, and that we are all actually equal, that we are all able to achieve what we want to do and can do, and that to be happy, we just need to pursue that. And when you do that, you will not only be a happy person, but you will always also be able to provide in anything you want and anything you need. It might not be necessarily easy or straightforward, but it will be accomplished and it will be done. Because guess what? It's easier to be true to yourself than trying to be somebody who you're not.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for those words of wisdom. They're very true, and I think a large majority of the people have forgotten that. I've been interviewing Philip Coppens on his book, The Ancient Alien Question, A New Inquiry into the Existence, Evidence, and Influence of Ancient Visitors. It's a very well thought out and researched book, one I would highly recommend. I also would like to remind the listeners that Ancient Aliens, the History Channel's popular series, is a very good source of information as well on this topic. And you can go back to the archives of Temple of Health and find interviews with many of the people who, like Philip, who are on that show. We've interviewed Stan Friedman a number of times and others as well. I think it's extremely important that we understand where we came from to understand where we're going. Philip, thanks very much for coming on the show. It's been delightful and very enlightening.
It's been a pleasure being on your show, and I hope to be on it again. And in the meantime, all the best.
Thank you very much. Love to have you back. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Let's see. We have the DIRT Committee. It's D-I-R-T Committee. Gail Hamilton has written a book on silicone implant problems. She will be on next week. And then Tricia McKinnon, my personal friend, will be on talking about galactic alignment 2012 and beyond on the 13th. And then on the 20th, we have spiritual growth with, I can't pronounce it, it's Etherogens, Psychoactive Sacramentals and Human Transformation. Anyway, join us again for Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb. Have a great week.
Thank you.